Hello and welcome. This is the Tribe Tech Podcast for people who want to know more about the future of tech in the Southwest. I'm Fayaz Khan and with me is Robert Hillier.
Hello, yes. And after the Tech Southwest Awards a couple of weeks ago, it's a bit calmer today. No one's in their dinner jacket or best dress or eating cheesecake.
Damn.
We're at the Stephen Scone offices in Exeter, home of our Tribe Tech sponsors.
It's late December 2019, so we're going to take a look back at the year and look ahead to 2020.
Did you know that in 1911, Richard Lucas of the Royal College of Surgeons said that by 2020, we'd have just one giant toe?
Okay, ew. But did you know the linguist John Watkins predicted 100 years ago that the letters C, Q and X would be gone from the alphabet because we'll mostly be spelling by sound and condensed ideas? LOL. GR8.
I was going to say GR8 because I did know that. And in 1980, I predicted that Plymouth Argyle would have had at least one season in the top division. I'm sticking to that forecast.
Oh, I would have thought you would have adjusted that by now. But
no, I'm holding to it.
So today we have some brilliant guests.
Yeah, we do. We are going to let them introduce themselves and tell us a bit about who they are and what they do.
And then we'll come back to you guys at the end of the podcast just to look forward to what we're doing next time.
On with the show.
You're listening to the Tribe Tech Podcast.
My name's Ben Travers and I head up the IP, IT and technology law team at a firm called Stephen Scone. We're one of the largest specialist technology law teams in the UK, and we help businesses both here and further afield to identify and commercialise opportunities in the technology space.
Perfect. We shall move to your right.
So I'm Kate Schofield. I'm currently working as a postdoctoral research fellow at Plymouth University on the Fab Soil project, making artificial soils from waste materials.
And to your right is...
I'm Mark Fitzsimons. I'm a professor of environmental chemistry at the University of Plymouth. I've been involved in working with the Fab Soil project for around about 8 years, but I also have a background in looking at marine environments and particularly nitrogen.
And I'm Anthony Peake. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Agile Datum, and we do cool stuff around artificial intelligence.
It does sound cool. Yeah. I'm looking forward to finding out more.
Tell me a little bit more about Agile Datum and what you've been doing in the last few months. I know you've started a hackathon with the Alan Turing Institute.
Yeah, so we set up Agile Datum about 6 months ago as a data science company, doing all sorts of things with data. We've been training AI to automate lots of processes for councils. One of the areas is in planning. So it's a really poor process, lots of admin, things humans don't like. So we've been training the computers to take away all of that admin. Last week, we spent a whole week with, must have been about 50 universities and 100 researchers at the Alan Turing Institute in London, looking at cool ways to get computers to read forms, read drawings, make decisions for people. Really good week.
Does it need to be a cool way, or does it just need to be effective? Because how effective is it if, for example, you know, a person can see if there are errors on a form, but a machine doesn't necessarily see that?
Yeah, in planning, there are about 12 common problems that deal in 40% of applications being rejected. And there's 3.5 million applications each year. Any process that has 1.4 million citizens being told they can't do something has to be a pretty poor process. When there's about 12 basic things, six things, people have picked the wrong form, they haven't filled in a section, they've miscalculated the price, basic stuff. But yeah, you send in your application to the council, you don't hear anything for 3 weeks. Mm. So you're bound to be picking up the phone, phoning them, saying what's going on. That interrupts them more, that slows them down more. So we've been training the computers to read the forms. You'd be surprised how, as a human, I look at a form, I look at a drawing. As a five-year-old, I probably can tell the difference between a form and a drawing. Mm-hmm. As a computer, you really have to train it to do those. So we've actually built a library of 17.5 million planning applications.
Wow.
So that's been able to train the computer to actually take over and do this work. Nice thing is, it frees up the staff to be able to deal with citizens.
How long did that take?
It's taken us 6 months to build the system, and we're now trialling it with a number of councils.
I mean, nobody enjoys going through those things at all, but you know, why has it taken so long?
I think it's a combination of two things, and Brexit might come in to change things, but there are lots of regulations, and councils tend to adopt every regulation, which then tends to be a reason why things are slower. 50% of budgets have been cut over the last 10 years, so there's half the staff in the department that they used to have. The combination of having to deal with regulation and not having enough people means that the last person in the loop is the citizen and their experience of the process. Mm-hmm. And as a citizen, you are about to do some building. Even if you don't need permission, you're still going to ask someone because it's your life savings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's definitely something we have to come back to.
And we'll come back to the rest of your 2019. Sure. It's only fair that we open up the floor. So, Mike, if you look back at this year, what stood out for you? What's been your 2019 highlight?
Well, I was made a professor, which was quite nice.
Must have worked.
Congratulations.
And won the Tech Southwest Research Award.
Well done.
So, really, what else could you say? It's been very interesting to see how the Fab Soil project has engaged such a wide audience. We started the year with a feature on BBC Spotlight in collaboration with the Eden Project, who we work closely with, talking about the soils, how they were designed, and what we're trying to do to see how they can be made sustainable for the next 50 to 100 years and build in resilience against the climate changes that are being predicted and the pressures that will be made on soils. And on the basis of that, then Reuters saw the press release and wanted to do a feature which put us on a global platform. Apart from that, it's been working with local businesses to see how we can help them to make the best use of waste materials they're producing and to reuse them in a technology that is hopefully going to make a significant difference to food security, to the production of speciality crops, for example, and something that can have a global reach.
And Kate, this is your project obviously as well. How has the Fab Soil programme come alive for you in the past 12 months?
I mean, really, I've returned to it in the last six, did my PhD on the topic, finished that in 2015, and I went away for a while and worked in industry, but I was able to come back onto the project in June, and so it was exciting to see how it's evolved. Going from just doing little bits of lab work, you know, during my PhD, and it was kind of relatively new and unknown, and now it's really garnered a lot of interest from a lot of different directions as well. So it's quite exciting to think of all the possibilities and things we could do.
So what stage have you got to? Are you still in the lab stage, or have you now started to move outside into real land, as it were?
Well, we're doing both. As Kate mentioned, she was the pioneering researcher on the project when we started. That was through a European Social Fund research project in partnership with the Eden Project to see how their soils were performing. And as a result of that, we were able to secure funding from the European Regional Development Fund to work directly with businesses and see how we could help them to contribute to what is our goal. That's a sustainable soil that's made from waste materials, something that's of a proven quality, similar to the top soils that one could buy. So that requires both the engagement with businesses to look at the possibilities, but also the experimental work we need to do to show how the soil is performing, and that's an ongoing thing.
Do you think it could have happened anywhere else apart from Plymouth? Has that got the expertise and the backgrounds and the technology and the know-how that's required to take it forward?
I think the link we were able to form with the Eden Project was really key to it, because they'd had these soils in place since 2001. So it's kind of like a real proof of concept that we were able to study something that had been established and then look at how to develop it and improve it. That close link was something that only Plymouth had and was really key to that. Also having the analytical support and experience looking at specific nutrients that we knew were key for plant growth. was there at Plymouth.
And Ben, can you tell us about 2019 for Stephen Scone?
Yeah, it's been a good year. Lots of different trends that have pulled together. One of the highlights, which I think pulled a lot of those trends together, was the work we did on a funded report into space technology and barriers for UK businesses embracing opportunities in the space sector. We were a delivery partner on that project with the University of Exeter, a European Space Agency funded project, which brought together some leading thinkers in that sector, some industry players from all over the country to the southwest to meet and discuss some of those issues. As a lawyer, that's a fantastic opportunity. It's a truly intellectual exercise where you can dig deep into lots of different areas of law and start pulling out things that you've learnt from dealing with AI or things that you might have learnt from dealing with big data, all sorts of different areas, and start pulling together in ways that can inform and influence policy going forward.
What are some of the main barriers that the UK has with regards to space technology?
So a lot of them are fairly terrestrial. Many of the traditional barriers that worry businesses, so insurance, liabilities, all of those sorts of things. There's a lot of talk about jurisdictional issues and which territory's law is going to apply to certain situations, which is a bit of a red herring, because although that puts a lot of businesses off, the few treaties that we do have on what happens in space means that a lot of the territorial issues disappear. Where objects are launched from, for example, can make a difference to legal liabilities that follow. But those, whilst they may sound like scary issues at the beginning, are usually quite easy to overcome and to plot out and make some sensible decisions about where you might launch from, for example. There's also businesses starting to understand that they're using space technology, even if they don't realise it. So one of the biggest sectors is agri-tech, for example, where lots of data about what's going on Earth is generated from space. And those businesses just starting to understand the regime for how they can use that data, where it comes from, how it's licensed, and again, liability issues and all of those sorts of things. That, and probably a broader fear of the unknown. A lot of businesses are just afraid to ask the question because they think it's going to be, or they think the answers are going to be what they don't want to hear. But actually, when they start digging into it, there's usually ways around it. Also, because it's such a new thing, there are huge areas where the law is silent. So there are opportunities for business, for governments, for people with interest to steer the direction that goes.
Yeah, it is quite an interesting part because, I mean, we expected space technology to be much further advanced in 2020 or 2019 than it is, right? But it's not. I don't think it's where it should be or where we thought it would be.
Well, we were looking, weren't we, this morning at predictions that have been made for 2020 in the past. Obviously some of them are fairly light, but one that did come up again and again was that, you know, by 2020 we will be on Mars and we will be colonising Mars. And I think people expect space technology to lead to tangible, almost sci-fi outcomes, don't they, as opposed to the less tangible benefits, as you've mentioned there, with agri-tech, which we actually see, which is why if you take a kind of Trumpian view of the world, NASA's a failure because we're not on Mars. Mm. But of course NASA itself, I assume, isn't viewing its successor otherwise in, you know, what kind of spacesuit there.
Yeah, and for us it's an interesting area because the law is usually behind the tech. So if you look at the way AI has evolved, there are still some fundamental issues and questions being asked about the legal regime that goes around that, with liability and ownership and content and all those sorts of things. And as AI becomes more prevalent and you start having less and less businesses claiming to have AI when actually what they've got is a fancy spreadsheet, and as a result these issues become more real, the legislators are starting to catch up. With space technology it's the other way around. There are symposiums and conferences and papers being written on all sorts of issues. Recently there's been a lot of noise about mining. The technology and society are a long way from being in a position to mine anything in space, but it's such a big issue that it's being thought of up front, and that's unusual, I think, for any form of tech.
I saw you nodding, Anthony, when Ben was talking about AI. I mean, what are your...
Yeah, I love anything that makes the experience for a user far better. Thinks about the user, thinks about their engagement, thinks about the how time poor we are, and the fact that we just want to get an answer to something fairly quickly, and we want to be treated like humans. And it's a strange way of thinking, but I apply that to AI. Anything where humans have to do lots of drudge and manual processes is somewhere where a computer can take over without threatening people. But Ben's right, there's a lot of ethics that has to go into it. We have to understand what we're doing with the data. We have to understand how we've calculated answers. We have to be able to interrogate it afterwards, should it cause a problem. But those things to one side, the reason I think it's cool is because I'm seeing lots of small companies, big companies, small councils, big government, finding ways of freeing up staff to be able to focus on more complex issues, more needed services, and not having to move spreadsheets around and copy data from one thing to another. With budget cuts, etc., government and local government certainly can't afford to have people doing that drudge when the needs of citizens are increasing.
What about people who say that sort of work is taking jobs away from people who might not be able to do anything?
But this is
else.
About the argument around our resistance to automation, is around those creative solutions, the ability to work in teams, isn't it? That, so we have to accept this, and from what I understand from your angle, is that if you can control that as opposed to have it imposed upon you, then you actually can be able to make it work in your...
Yeah, I mean, I see it very much as sort of augmenting the role. So what we'll often do is we'll go in and we'll look at the data. How many calls are you having? You know, what are the reasons for those calls? We might even train a chatbot to be able to answer. So we've done that in planning. We've trained a chatbot to be able to answer 250 standard questions. And if we can give the department 15% of extra capacity back when they've had 50% taken off them, it frees them up to be able to think. Humans hate change. Humans resist change. And in local government particularly, they've seen change coming a number of times. That hasn't happened, so if I hide long enough, it's going to go away again. But the great thing here is as soon as they start to see the technology is actually freeing them up to be able to think better, they adopt it fairly quickly, and then they're ready for the next bit.
Tribe Tech.
I'm going to ask Mark and Kate's view on this, but don't wait for me to ask you, chip in as you see fit. Thinking about what you've all been saying about the past year and going back a bit, and we've got very different sectors in the room, the historical view of this year will be Brexit, another election following on from Brexit and another election, and that will kind of be the political historical part of this time. And yet you're all carrying on and moving things forward and not waiting to see what happens but getting on with stuff. So do you think that maybe what's happened over the past few years has actually helped people, I'm gonna almost say, take back control, but actually think about, we can't wait for this stuff anymore. And so really, is what we're seeing, is it as important as maybe we think it is? Or do you think that because of the challenges that are faced by waiting to see what's going to happen, you've just, I mean, you mentioned the fact that the funding has come from EIBF.
Yes.
Presumably you won't stop because that stops.
Certainly we'll have to plan ahead for other opportunities to get the work funded and to work with businesses. But I think that from what I can see, the models of continuing this type of work are going to continue very very much along the lines of the ERDF. So for example, the local enterprise partnerships are currently writing strategies for, I suppose, what will now be a post-EU funding landscape. There's very much the incentive to take things on, take the projects that are of interest on, and the areas that need to be focused on. And there's the opportunity for us to be involved in setting the agenda.
And so do you still anticipate that if you've got something that people want, that the money will still come from
somewhere?
Yes, that's the optimistic thought that you keep when you're doing research. You're used to failure, so you say our failure CV with all of the ideas that weren't funded and projects that we spent, or proposals weren't funded, it would probably be 10 or 20 times the amount of funding that we've actually got in. So there's a resilience, I think.
There's been the point that you made about almost for the first time being ahead of the game a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because governments are just simply not set up to deal with the complexities of the ideas that are coming forward?
I think there could be an element of that. I think there's also an element of
the ethics and the legal issues sitting side by side, and the people legislating on the legal issues only when the public become aware of things. Perhaps with the space technology example, what's at risk is so great that they can't act reactively to public opinion on that at the time. Certainly we're seeing, on the funding point, lots of funding out there from lots of various different sources to try and generate innovation, to try and push new technology across various sectors. So now it seems to be a relatively good time, aside from whatever might be happening in the market, to look for funding opportunities to help launch products or do R&D in products. And probably I'd say the last couple of years that's been the case.
I'd say for Southwest businesses, quite often people think we're a little bit remote from London and we're not getting the help. Strangely, since setting up Agile Datum, we've been able to get EU funding via a digital catapult, which is a government program, to fund a hackathon with the Alan Turing Institute. That was 2 one-page forms. Okay, it was 4 phone calls, but that was about it. It wasn't hard. We've been able to get funding from Innovate UK to do a knowledge transfer program, KTP, with Exeter University, which is just about to kick off for 2 years. And so we were interviewing staff yesterday for that. We've been able to get onto the Science Park in Exeter, and through there, lots of contacts. So we're about to do some interesting work of taking 2D plans and automatically creating 3D. On the Science Park, there's the Impact Lab that's had EU funding. They're now doing a business plan for me and researching the need in the market. All the sorts of things that lots of businesses need. And I'm actually finding that there are lots of one-page forms online that unlock these things. And it's, I think a lot of people have got themselves into a mentality where that help's not there, so I can't do it. Actually, I'm finding the smallest businesses with, yeah, planning, I say cool. I must be one of the only people who say cool around planning. But it's a fairly mundane industry, but yet there are lots of innovations that can go on in any company. And I'm finding, and certainly my point to any Southwest business is get out there, fill in the forms, get the help.
What happens when the EU funding isn't available then? Because
the UK Research Institute, so UKRI, is sort of taking over. So Innovate UK and a number of them, 4 different bodies, have all come together. If the money doesn't go abroad, it'll stay here and it will still be funded in some way. We've all feared it wouldn't be. I'm not finding that to be the truth.
So that's where you guys go when you want to find anxious. Move over to the LEP and to Innovate UK and wherever else.
Yes, would make applications to the Research Council anyway. It depends on the nature of the project. That would tend to be perhaps more blue skies research, whereas the applied research and the links with businesses would come from another source. And I think Innovate UK certainly has that desire to match academic capital, as it were, with business needs.
If we go back to 2015 and when you completed your PhD, how blue sky was that at the time? Do you feel now that you would get the funding for that if you were thinking about that idea now?
I'd like to think it would. It was a project that enabled the Eden Project to learn more about what they had at the time. And then, so now this latest phase is sort of moving forward and looking at how they can then use that to boost their own business, as well as added resource throughout the Southwest and boost it further afield as well. But I think the EU funding really was quite instrumental to it. It was part of a fund to get extra money and research investment in Cornwall. And there still is a lack of sort of recognition of the research that goes on in that area. And I'd argue that any loss of that kind of income is a concern.
But Anthony, you feel that it is, though, if you know where to look, and so actually the help might be in directing people to the right place.
Yeah, I am seeing the university struggling more to get pure academic research funded, but I am seeing them then reach out to business and taking business ideas. There's lots of pharma tech going on in your space, where there's lots of innovative companies. Set Squared is an incubator run by the university. It's on the Science Park. I'm part of that. And I'm seeing sort of agri, farming based technologies coming through with some entrepreneurs who are now being put in front of Innovate UK. They're being put in front of, there was 20 of us that presented to 150 investors the week before last. So, you know, actually, I think the Southwest has some really good programs. I agree, in the academic space, there is a lot of fear that some of the bigger pure research things are not being funded.
So, Ben, have you seen a change in the nature and the type and the volume of companies coming to you?
Yes, I think people are understanding the value of looking at intellectual property and big data issues legally, again, perhaps led by the consumer demand for those things. We're seeing a lot more engagement, echoing your thoughts, with the academic institutions and local businesses. So that's been really good. The Set Squared initiative, which you mentioned there, we're advisors in residence for that. That's a really positive thing for the region. I think on the funding point, again, the businesses are starting to be more imaginative in looking for various funds. So instead of looking for technology funds or funds in their particular sector, they might look at funds which are trying to achieve a certain aim. So if they're, for example, doing something in health tech, they'll start looking at funding not for technology, but for things which are helping improve quality of life or life expectancy. Similarly, if they're looking at technology which brings people together through social media, it might be that they look at funds that are helping social wellbeing through combating loneliness and those sorts of things. So we're starting to see a much wider group of businesses that perhaps wouldn't have thought of themselves as technology businesses before, starting to engage with both the funding infrastructure, but also the law as it applies to tech businesses.
One of the themes that's emerged during the course of all the people we've spoken to, which echoes what Ben is saying, is not just companies who didn't see themselves as tech companies, but tech companies who didn't see themselves actually as being healthcare companies or as being sustainable. And that's interesting, isn't it? So stop seeing yourself as and using applying the word tech to yourself when in fact you're not. You are a lifestyle company, you are an automotive industry company.
What we find is people are saying, well, tech is a tool, not an industry. So you're part of various different industries, but actually the tools that you use are tech based. Well, we are going to come to that in a bit because we're going to talk about 2020 and what we see as the emerging tech that's going to become mainstream or not so emerging in some cases. But before we do that, should we finish off by talking about Christmas presents and gadgets?
You're listening to the Tribe Tech Podcast in collaboration with Stephen Scone. You can get in touch with us by tweeting TechSWOfficial.
Should we have some 2019 levity? Because I've got really serious.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I think we need to
move on. Which I didn't mean to do, but I got immersed in the subject.
You put on a hat.
You're wearing the Christmas jumper, so you can do
it. Well, I'll start with Ben because I'm looking at you. What are you giving for Christmas this year, gadget-wise?
The gadgets will be on my family's Christmas list or anything to do with sport and health and fitness, and there are some really neat bits of wearable tech coming out which are really cool when it comes to measuring performance of increasingly things like swimming, which has obviously been an issue in the past, waterproofing that tech. So I'm pretty sure that's going to be high on my kids' wish list.
I guess it's not like classic tech, but I'm kind of going for extra like snowboarding clothing. So like thermals that actually work.
Keep you warm.
Yeah.
Those exist. I can't find anything that keeps you warm. I'm always cold.
Well, I'll let you know if they work. But yeah, hopefully. So that's what I'm both getting and giving. It's a bit boring, but
no, it's the way forward.
I will be getting my wife a. So don't release that until after
she
Christmas.
She has one,
does she? Yeah, get it. An upgrade.
Okay. Well, my two children, 19 and 23, Oliver and Juliet, they it's university, so it's new laptops. And it has to be Apple.
Oh, obviously.
It has to be Apple. For myself, I'm going retro. I think I'm reflecting on life. So I my first job was launching the Macintosh for Apple, so I bought myself an old Macintosh, and then I went even more retro.
£10 million or something ridiculous.
No, they're not. eBay's
crazy.
Great. eBay's great. The next one will surprise you. I've gone even more retro. For myself, I bought myself an Enigma machine.
Wow.
Just because it looks cool. One of those little box things
oh,
you open up with the dials. It's a replica.
What's it for? I mean, obviously I don't what it sits there
in my office and everyone goes, oh, cool, it's an Enigma machine.
You can do...
No, I could probably encrypt all the files, but then no one will be able to ever work it out. I love the look of old tech.
No, what a great thing to have.
I was looking up 2019 gadgets, like what you should be giving out, and one of the things was a turntable, which I thought it's still since 2010, which is when, or 2009, when they first sort of started coming back, and they're still a thing that you should be giving out.
But why is it? What's the tech attached to it? Is it like a
that's the thing. It's not tech. It's not tech. But people are going retro with technology.
I bought a record player a couple of years ago.
Okay, well, I bought it.
I'm planning to. We moved house, so that's been put in storage. But now I'm planning to.
This isn't going to make it.
No.
what I'm about to say now. It's interesting that now, if you go into the Oxfam shop in Exeter. The cost of records in there, which I know 5 years ago would have been £1, is now 20.
Oh yes,
and they will give you CDs to free up space on the shelf for things that have more value. It is amazing. I don't know if at any point. I mean, the fact that people are now willing to use cassettes again, which is not a good way of listening to music.
What's that about?
I think that is pure nostalgia. It can only be.
Have you ever given a cassette player to a teenager recently?
Well, I have a cassette.
I gave one last year.
Give the player and the cassette to a teenager. It's hilarious.
Well, our daughters are 9, and one of them was pressing the button and just went, "What is this drawer on this?" It's not a drawer, it's a tape player.
The cassette thing really is, I mean, it can only just be pure nostalgia, can't it?
I think some purists will argue that it's a richer sound or something.
I mean, but
there really isn't.
Tribe Tech.
I would like to know what you think might make it into mainstream tech next year. A lot of people are talking about, I've been personally doing fintech. I mean, I love the fact that I can download an app and then it just saves money for me and I don't have to think about it at all. So it just, it's called Plum, and it just rounds up whatever payments I make and then saves, and I never even have to think about it. I don't have to think about it at all. And I think actually when I was younger, it probably would have been a bit more useful because it's quite small amounts. So it's not going to make a huge difference at the end of the year. So I actually do have to top it up. But I see fintech becoming extremely mainstream.
And another example there where it's called tech, and actually it's just a way of saving, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, so it's changing the way of thinking. So you must see a lot of...
Yeah.
Of that.
But people were saying law tech's a big thing as well. I don't know. What do you think?
Law tech is increasingly something that clients are asking for and are curious about. The products that are on the market still have a long way to go, certainly the ones that I've seen anyway in starting to replicate what lawyers do. Where the technology is helping is in streamlining a lot of the back office processes.
It's similar to Anthony's planning example.
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of 2020, rather than perhaps a sector, a trend which I think will go across various sectors, is an increasing transparency, particularly when it comes to big data. So I think as people are becoming more aware, whether it's fintech or health or sports or whatever it is, of how their data is being used in lots of different ways. We have the social media platforms this year talking about privacy being key. That, coupled with a greater understanding for consumers, means that businesses are going to have to change the way that they operate. And I can see a scenario, perhaps as early as next year, where consumers use their data as a commodity. So the provider, whether it's whatever sector it's in, will provide different levels of services, perhaps at no cost, but depending on how much of the data the individual is prepared to give. And so you could see before long a whole ecosystem emerging around the trading of that data as individuals start to see that the value that it has.
What do you think's the driver behind that? Why now?
The understanding that consumers are starting to have of where their data is going and that it has a value. You think back a couple of years, there was much surprise with consumers when they discovered that some of the online streaming services track what they watch so that they can make recommendations. People just didn't understand that even at that level that was happening. Similarly, all sorts of issues around technology in the home, listening to people. Smart speakers are a battleground we see from legal issues over the next 12 months.
whether that's advertising in the home, privacy issues, branding issues, all those sorts of things. So people have embraced this technology and the benefits of it, but over the last 6 or 12 months have started to realise that the price that they're paying, and as the legislative regime starts to empower consumers more, it's a natural progression, I think, that they say, well, hang about, what's in this for me? Where can I get something back?
So next year, actually, it is smart speakers are going to start advertising much more and much more aggressively than they are now, because it's very, now it's just recommending things, whereas apparently next year it's going to be quite a useful marketing tool for businesses. How is that going to work?
But there's going to be a whole raft of things for them to think about. So advertising is regulated. Advertising directly into people's homes is powerful stuff, particularly when it's targeted. So there is legislation to try and curb organisations from going too far on all of those things. But inevitably, there will be some players that push the boundaries and get fines and push back. And that organic process will enable people to see where the lines are, what's acceptable and what's not. And as ever, it will be led by the consumer.
On the assumption that a lot of people are aware, aren't they, to an extent that you can't subscribe to Netflix or Spotify without being aware that your behaviours are being mapped and you're being targeted. When you say people will ask what's in it for them, at what point does the fact that you can access cheap content when and where you want it on whatever device you have, is that so powerful that actually we are going to be willing to give up an awful lot of this?
I think there will be a threshold. I mean, historically, people have been prepared to give up those things. I remember a little while ago there was a piece of entertainment technology that was sold into homes, and it would listen to what people were doing whilst they were engaging with this. And there was much fuss when that was released in the press that this device was listening constantly to what people were up to in their homes. But it didn't do anything to sales. After about 48 hours, everybody sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it's convenient, and all the rest of it. But I do think that's changing as people start to see advertising being targeted more at them. If you give the consumer a choice, actually, where you can take this for free and you can benefit from the service, but your data's going to be traded, once they start to see the value that data has, then I don't think it takes much for the democratisation of that process, where consumers say, well, actually, I want a cut of that. If you're selling my data for pound sign X, I expect to have something back.
How would this impact any of your behaviours, do you think? Is this something that you do think about now and how your data is being used? I mean, you work in that field, so you are aware of how data is used and the power that it has.
I guess it comes down to also, like, just because you can, does it mean that you should use that data just because it's there? In terms of agri-tech, we're kind of not yet, I mean, with FabSoil, we're not yet at the right point where we could do that, but there's a lot of projects that do collect data from farms in terms of soil quality, and that's potentially quite sensitive. So if you know someone uses a particular type of treatment or and they've improved their soil and therefore improving their yield, then they probably work quite hard to get those results. And if suddenly that becomes available and sold elsewhere, it's how useful is that information? How valuable is it?
At the moment, will people give that to you for free because they see it as helping?
At the moment, we're in a position where we could be the ones to collect that data because we can do the analysis for them on the soil, which is still a fairly niche. People will send their samples out to labs, so they sample their soils from field. And those labs will, usually under the understanding that the results only go back to the farmer. When other places start to collect databases of them, it's not something we do on FabSoil, but there are other projects that have that kind of overarching control of data.
I think our objective is to add value to the product, whether it's green waste or perhaps an aggregate waste from that would possibly go to landfill with the cost associated with that we can provide data that is of direct benefit to the businesses we're partnering with, but also can be used in a global sense to show the potential of using this mixture of materials for a soil.
We've been working with a number of businesses on chatbots, I mentioned before, and you know, a chatbot on planning where you're saying, when will I get my approval? What does this mean? How do I do one of these? Do I need to apply? There's nothing particularly sensitive in there. But if you move that same chatbot into social care, got people talking about bodily function, really sensitive information, I'm taking the approach of exposing all of the issues to the clients before they think of it. So that I will naturally say, we do not retain any of this information within the chatbot, it's automatically onto your services, etc. But companies are just beginning to wake up to, actually, there is a lot of sensitive information that we are capturing. How do I handle it? And, you know, government data protection regulations, GDPR, have made people aware of this. From a consumer side, Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the internet, is basically starting to push his next movement, which is about owning your own personal data. I love millennials and that millennial way of thinking, which is, if it's going to do some social good, I don't mind sharing it. So the fact that you could do maybe a clinical trial and you could find out about people in a certain demographic who've had a certain issue, who spend certain money, and you can build models around that. Millennials will buy into the side of, fine, I can share my data, and that research could be done in seconds rather than years. But at the same time, there is a naivety in the value of that data.
Should we get a bit more into actual 2020 and what we think might happen?
Yeah, let's just do a quick round table of what sort of technology do you see becoming mainstream in 2020?
And I think that's what I'd like to know, because obviously I'm assuming a bit of 2020 is quite a pivotal year for you and what happens with your project next, and so I would imagine the same with you. You can't obviously write a whole year off. Everything needs to be moving quickly, and you'll have your targets as well. So
hope will be that we can deliver on the partnerships with businesses in terms of getting data that's of value both to them and to the research community. I'm seeing the potential for some global collaborations, for example, possible collaborations for some experimental work and training with partner groups in Africa, which would be great. And also we are getting some wider contact with businesses in the UK who we can't directly help through the Fab Soil project because it's focused on Cornwall, but who have seen some of the releases and the press that we've got on the project and have come to approach us. What I would really like to work on is how we can reduce the use of really precious resources such as peat, which is routinely used in compost and for some growing, and move towards a more sustainable compost that's composed from green waste.
And how far down that road are you? How far away do you think you might be?
Well, we've made contact with a business that sees it as something they want to address from a sustainability point of view. So that's the first step. We haven't established any formal collaborations or have any funded work in that area. But in terms of the value that are being put on peatlands, the fact that the UK has declared a climate emergency and lots of the university and Plymouth City Council, I think there's a real, for me, I think that gives a space for new thinking, and the soil management and waste management world is quite risk averse currently, and I think we have to move towards rethinking that and look at more of a cost benefit, a risk benefit question, rather than simply have some type of block because it's always been there in terms of potentially safety or perhaps some components of the soil that might be currently heavily regulated. We need to think about the benefits of doing something. Why not, instead of why?
Okay, it's your baby, as it were. What do you hope might be next for Fab Soil?
I'm quite excited about some of the experiments that I'm going to hopefully start from January. So starting to look at different ingredients that we could incorporate into these soils, looking at waste materials from other regions and how we can incorporate those to replicate soils, say, from like the north, like Cumbria. So the soils from Cornwall tend to be based on like China clay waste and mining waste, whereas that wouldn't be an appropriate product to use in a soil that we want to deploy in Cumbria. So we'd look at stuff. A slate mined base instead,
looking at the impact of biological diversity and how we can like kickstart these soils and sort of supercharge them so they'll start growing really effectively really quickly. And in terms of tech, I'm quite excited by the progress being made in sensor technology. So rather than sending someone out to dig a hole, bring the sample back, analyse it, and the whole process can take a few weeks sometimes, you can just attach it to a robot that will drive across the field, log its position and tell you the soil properties there and then, and you get really instant feedback and really high resolution mapping of different areas of land. I think that's quite an exciting.
And you can spend more time doing what it is you need to do and not out with your wellies on.
Yeah, and waiting for a search.
And from my side, it's rolling out AI more across the councils, providing better services for the citizens, freeing up the staff in the council to be able to do the good work that they always intended to do by joining those councils. I think from a general technology point of view, well, there's two sides, from a political and a technology. From the technology side, Internet of Things, particularly 5G, I think we will start to see that. We will have some challenges of invasion of privacy. There are people talking about lampposts listening and how you can create services to identify potholes by the noise, but equally lampposts will be listening. And that scares the hell out of me. And so
you've got
again,
nothing, as they say, if you've got nothing to hide, and this is always the language that's used, isn't it? If you've got nothing to hide, then what are you worried
about? I've got
about?
Nothing
what,
to hide except
stage,
my privacy.
Yeah. And at what stage, as we were discussing earlier, is enough.
Yeah.
Is the, you know.
So yeah, I mean, but some of the benefits, you know, I don't think we're going to be seeing drones delivering food next year. I think that's going to be a little while off. I don't think we're going to be seeing too many autonomous vehicles properly driving on the road on their own. I'd look forward to be able to sleep in the car while it's going somewhere. That would be really nice. But what I do see is the infrastructure starting to be rolled out, and because of that rollout, ahead of the need for it, for autonomous vehicles, drones, etc., it means that we'll see those technologies in rural areas. So therefore, it will now start to give better signal and better internet and other things to rural communities, and bring them into the modern age and bring them into, you know, economic advantage. So I think that's one side. I think from the political side, to me, it's a post-Brexit world. I'm anti-Brexit. I think the more we see citizens from other nations, etc., the better we'll all be. However, to finally have a government with a majority that they can actually get something done, to start to see discussions other than Brexit, businesses are beginning to feel more buoyant about the future and therefore they can invest, and so, you know, that will trickle down to salary increases for staff, benefits, those sorts of things. So actually I think ultimately I'm hoping, very hopeful for next year, that we get on and sort out climate and other things rather than talking about Brexit.
Well, thank you guys so much for being on the podcast with us. Don't know how much of this is going to make it. I would say 45 minutes, so the best bits, which was all of it from what
we'll, we'll do it again same time next year.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Tribe Tech podcast in association with Stephen Scone. Next time, we'll be talking about well-being and how tech can be used for it.
Yeah, that will be in 2020, space age.
I mean, we really should be having flying cars by now.
Well, the next one will be coming live from Moonbase Alpha.
We actually do have self-driving cars, so we're not far off.
Not on Moonbase Alpha.
No, sadly.
Anyway, I'm off to have my Christmas dinner, which is the size of a pea.
That's because you're a vegetarian.
Correct.
It probably is a pea.
This has lost its way.
Never mind. Well, thanks for listening to the Tribe Tech podcast. We have loved doing this with you guys over the past 3 months. Keep listening. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. That's the way forward, people. Subscribe.
Bye.
The Tribe Tech podcast. In collaboration with Stephen Scone. You can get in touch with us by tweeting TechSWOfficial.